establishment, 259 Broadway. According to family legend, Malachi's ancestor, Davenport Talmadge, had been in possession of papers that detailed all the amulets, ornaments, and stones that made up the lost cache of memory tools. Smuggled out of India and brought into Egypt before 1500 BC, these items were said to be able to stimulate past life memories. Had Davenport written the note? Did it refer to the list of lost tools? Without too much trouble, by matching the handwriting to letters in the archives, Malachi had been able to ascertain the note had been written by Davenport Talmadge, one of the original founders of the Phoenix Club. Knowing who'd written it had enabled Malachi to further narrow the note's provenance to sometime between 1884 and 1901. No earlier than 1884, as that was when Davenport had inherited his brother's estate and taken over running the club. And no later than 1901, as that had been the year Davenport had died. The address, 259 Broadway, was where the jewelry, stationery, and design firm of Tiffany & Company had been located during that era. Was Mr. T. Tiffany himself? Probably. Davenport had been immensely wealthy. What objet d'art had Tiffany made at Davenport's request in order to hide the papers? Had the item been sold? Or did it still exist here in the mansion, where nearly every room boasted numerous Tiffany lamps and windows? Not to mention all the mansion's fireplaces, which were fronted with iridescent tiles fastened by the famous glassmaker and jeweler, meaning the papers could very well be hidden in plain sight. An aggravating idea, that they could be so close and yet remain invisible to him. Now Malachi turned the pages to his notes from the last few weeks, the section where he'd recorded his sessions with Mr. John Wen. There had been 8 sessions in all, each one going over and over the same territory. An antiques dealer, Wen had come to Malachi for help in understanding why he was drawn to certain objects and places. He was haunted by them, obsessed. For years, he'd been trying to get clarity on the feelings that gripped him upon seeing certain items. Twice, he'd almost gone bankrupt buying up estates that were not worth what he paid, just to ensure that he could get a certain piece. Desperate, he'd finally allowed for the possibility that past life memories were driving him. In searching for someone to help him, he'd heard about Dr. Samuels and claimed that somehow he felt the same way about coming here that he did about the antiques. He just knew the Phoenix Foundation was the place he'd find help. But what Wen didn't know, at least not consciously, but that he'd revealed to Malachi under hypnosis, was that in the past, over 130 years ago, he'd been one of the Talmadge brothers who'd founded this very institution. And if he was the incarnation of Davenport or Trevor, then maybe, Malachi had theorized, Wen could lead him to the fabled papers. To anyone else, it would have been a story to scoff at. But Malachi had worked with thousands of children whose past life memories he and his aunt had verified. Malachi had seen his patients make connections that defied logic and what others called reason. Malachi had never had a past life memory of his own. No amount of hypnosis or meditation worked for him. But he'd seen his patients cured of their fears, phobias, and neuroses once they were able to identify them and understand they belonged to previous incarnations. He'd witnessed the healing power of regained memories, the astounding relief his patients felt once freed from their karmic nightmares. All Malachi wanted was to know his own past lives. But to do that, he needed a functioning memory tool, and in order to find one of the few fabled tools, he needed to know which item he was searching for. Davenport's papers would be his map, a complete list of all the known memory tools. And he'd thought that perhaps John Wen, a Chinese art and antiques dealer from Boston, had possessed the clue to finally unearthing Davenport's long-lost papers. Which meant John Wen's murder wasn't just a shame. It was downright inconvenient. Dr. Malachi Samuels had bested her. There was no way around it. In the 3 days following her day trip to New York, back in Boston, Dee Dee had turned the conversation around and around in her mind. She shared the discussion, or rather the lack of it, with her squad mates Phil and Neil. She even called and reported her lack of interviewing prowess to Special Agent Lucien Glass. She'd gone up against a person of interest in 4 potential murders, and she'd gleaned nothing. Not a single shred of information or insinuation. Just the rather prosaic observation that antiques dealers identified with the past, which clearly explained her current need for dim sum. When dealing with an extremely troubling murder in Chinatown, dim sum was the way to go. But if John Wen imported antiques because he identified with the past, what did his killer care about? All of those priceless items in the shop, and the murderer had taken just one thing, a jade Buddha. Why that? Dee Dee spotted the proprietor of the popular restaurant waiting patiently next to the door. An older Asian gentleman in an impeccably cut suit, he had already greeted most of his customers by name. It occurred to her he might be able to help her out. She raised a hand to catch his attention, and he promptly walked over. "Excuse me," she said. "Could you tell me where the closest Buddhist temple is in Chinatown?"
"There are several, detective. Which one are you looking for?"
"How'd you know I was a detective?"
"You are investigating the murder of John Wen. We all know."
"Did you know Mr. Wen?"
"Yes, a very fine man. He helped me find the 4 silk screens hanging in the banquet room. In fact, if you are interested in Buddhist temples, may I suggest you consult Mr. Wen's assistant, Miss Chan?"
Dee Dee regarded him blankly. "Why Judy Chan?" The proprietor's turned to appear flustered.
"Because of her pendant, of course. The small jade Buddha she always wears around her neck. A symbol of her own religious calling, I would assume."
Dee Dee thanked the man for his time. Then she paid her bill and got on the phone to her partner, Phil. Because they'd interviewed Judy several times, and on none of those occasions was Mr. Wen's beautiful assistant wearing a jade Buddha pendant. Which made her wonder what else Judy Chan had to hide. According to Phil, Judy Chan's home address was a 4th-floor walk-up, just around the corner from the restaurant in Chinatown. Dee Dee found the brick building easily enough. Unfortunately, no one answered Judy's buzzer. A quick ring of the 2nd-floor unit, however, earned her an elderly Chinese woman in a pink floral housecoat. Dee Dee flashed her shield, providing a quick impression of official public servant. "Fire department," Dee Dee announced. One of the first things she'd learned in community policing? Most inner-city populations didn't trust cops. Firemen, on the other hand, who could save their homes and businesses from burning down, were treated with respect. The old woman studied her critically.
"I need to conduct a test of the fire escapes. Just making sure everything is in working order."
A frown. Growing uncertainty. The older woman's natural suspicion of such an odd request, warring with her desire to feel her apartment building was fire safe. Dee Dee pressed ahead.
"Just need quick access, so I can take a walk up and a walk down. I'll be in and out in 5 minutes, and your building will be cleared for another 5 years. Otherwise, I gotta bring the fire marshal down, maybe a whole inspection crew."
The promise, threat, of more city officials got the job done. The aging tenant gestured for Dee Dee to follow her into her apartment, and 3 minutes later, Dee Dee was climbing up the fire escape to Judy's 4th-floor unit. She didn't have probable cause to enter the unit, of course. Just a growing suspicion that Judy Chan hadn't been fully forthcoming. But a quick glimpse of the woman's living space wouldn't hurt. And if Dee Dee happened to spy something, such as an 8-inch-tall stolen jade Buddha statue, or even better, a smoking gun, then voila, Dee Dee would be within her rights to access the woman's apartment and maybe even close a murder case. With a bit of effort, Dee Dee heaved herself onto the fourth floor platform, staggering to her feet. Her hands hurt from gripping the rusty metal fire escape, not to mention her heart was pounding painfully in her chest. Then she looked up. Holy crap! Buddhas. Everywhere. Judy Chan's fourth floor unit was covered in images of the laughing Buddha. Buddha paintings, Buddha statues, Buddha embroidered pillows, even tiny gold and jade and silver Buddha figurines. Everywhere Dee Dee looked, for as far as the eye could see, was yet another image of the Buddha. Then, as she stood there, still open-mouthed, the front door of Chan's apartment opened. John Wen's former assistant entered her home, accompanied by Dr. Malachi Samuels. Malachi felt good about his day. Indeed, after learning that Mr. John Wen had been killed, taking with him any clues the man might have possessed regarding the location of the legendary list of lost memory tools, Malachi had been forced to reconsider his strategy. The police, including that blonde Boston detective Dee Dee Warren, would be watching him, which ruled out any overt acts, such as searching Wen's antiquity shop or personal residence. Then it had occurred to Malachi that he didn't need to engage in such base acts when a simple gesture of courtesy would suffice. He had called Wen's assistant, a beautiful woman he'd met once when she'd accompanied Wen to the Phoenix Foundation in New York, and extended his deepest condolences. If there was anything he could do to help Miss Chan during this time of sadness, he was available. In fact, he'd be in Boston by the end of the week. Perhaps they could meet for a cup of tea, share reminiscences of a man they had both respected and admired. Malachi's father had long ago taught him the value of a well-cut suit, impeccable social standing, and a cultured voice. Miss Judy Chan had agreed nearly immediately. The morning tea progressed to a casual stroll around Boston's Chinatown, an amazing cultural center, third largest in the country. And then finally to Malachi's delicate request to visit Wen's store one last time. Miss Chan had been happy to comply. If they could simply stop by her apartment first in order to retrieve the key. Malachi had followed her up the four flights of stairs without complaining, despite the discomfort in his leg. An incident in Vienna years before had left a permanent disability that he did his best to ignore. Standing beside her, he waited as the young woman opened the door to her residence. And then he received his first shock of the day. Buddhas. Figurines, carvings, paintings, embroideries, silk washings. Images of a kind, benevolent Buddha everywhere one looked. Miss Chan, her tailored knee-length camel-colored coat still buttoned to her chin, paused, glanced at him self-consciously.
I am a collector, she said.
Indeed. Malachi raised his hands to assist the lady with her coat. Suddenly, he was not in a hurry to continue on to Wen's shop. The truth, he realized, the key to the secret he had sought for so long, was here. One modern-day woman's obsession. A trained therapist's insight into a reincarnated soul.
Could I trouble you for a glass of water? He suggested now. I'm afraid the walk up the stairs has left me parched.
Of course.
Freed of her coat, Judy headed smartly toward the modest galley kitchen. Alone in the room, Malachi started in on the buttons of his own immense black wool greatcoat, while taking a quick inventory of the room. Was it his imagination? Or did he just see a shadow flash behind the window? No matter. He could already feel his blood quicken, a familiar thrumming in his veins. All these years later, the Buddha, with his enigmatic smile and numerous teachings on karma and reincarnation, held the key.
When did you first start collecting Buddhas? He asked, as Judy re-entered the room.
She handed him a tumbler of water,
and he could detect a faint tremor in her fingers as the glass passed from her to him.
I'm not really sure. All my life, I suppose.
Did Mr. Wen know?
Of course.
She flushed, her hand resting self-consciously on her chest.
He even gifted me with a jade Buddha medallion, a talisman of sorts.
Did Mr. Wen ever speak of his sessions with me?
I know he was seeing you about his own collecting issues. His terrible need at times to acquire items whether they made sound business sense or not. He said you believed he was a reincarnated soul, still looking for something he had lost many lives ago.
And you? The young woman stilled, then twisted her head slightly to take in the full surroundings of her apartment. Her hair moved with her, a black silk curtain that obscured her face from him.
I do not know why I do what I do, she whispered finally. A born-again soul, still searching to right a wrong? It makes as much sense to me as anything.
Might I suggest a short hypnosis session? Malachi offered quietly. It won't take more than 30-40 minutes of your time, and might very well provide you with some of the answers you seek. In fact, I could do it right here in the comfort of your home. She didn't answer him so much as she moved closer to the couch. Then, after another moment of hesitation, took a seat. Malachi didn't wait for a second invitation. He slipped off his coat, eased into a dainty bamboo-framed chair across from her, and, incredibly aware of the Buddha's watching eyes, he began by using a simple backward-counting technique to slowly lead his patient through the curling ribbons of time. Where are you? He asked 5 minutes later. Judy described a mansion, partially hidden behind linden trees.
What?
Malachi leaned forward, not sure he could yet make the assumption he was yearning to make.
Tell me, what do you see? What do you hear?
A carriage driving by. Horses' hooves. It's twilight and people are arriving home from their day's work. I hear strains of Beethoven's Moonlight Sonata.
Do you know the street where this mansion is?
Of course. 83rd Street off of Central Park West.
She was describing his ancestral home, Malachi realized, his excitement growing as he sought to maintain an even composure, a soothing, rhythmic voice. Judy Chan had returned to what was now the Phoenix Foundation in New York City, sometime in the late 19th century. This was truly fascinating because the first time he'd put John Wen under, the antiques dealer had returned to the exact same place and time. To anyone else, it would have been a coincidence, but not to Malachi. There were no coincidences when you were dealing with reincarnation. Every act had repercussions, every encounter a purpose. We return to be with the same people in similar circumstances to complete the karmic circle, to right our wrongs, to be given another chance. Souls whose fates were forever intertwined, finding each other again and again and again, following a repeating pattern of doom. Every time Malachi witnessed a patient travel, he felt privileged to be part of the journey. But this time, he also felt ebullient. His own family history, complicated and mysterious, might finally be resolved. John Wen had been shot and killed by an intruder in his study, just as Malachi's ancestor Trevor Talmadge had been shot and killed over 100 years ago. Murdered in his own study by an intruder, according to family lore. Or had he been? Upon Trevor's death, his brother Davenport had inherited the house and everything in it, including Malachi's longed-for treasure, the list of lost memory tools. And now, as Malachi listened to Judy Chan describe every detail of a study she couldn't know in a time period she shouldn't be able to recall, Malachi felt another piece of the puzzle slide into place.
What are you doing there? Malachi asked.
My brother is wrong,
Judy Chan said, answering a different question, her voice stronger than it had been a moment ago. She was sitting up straighter, too, Malachi noticed, her demeanor becoming more agitated.
What is your name? Malachi asked.
She didn't answer his question. Instead, she continued arguing with a ghost Malachi couldn't see or hear.
The decision to publish is not your choice.
Publish what?
Malachi asked. Who are you talking to?
My brother, Judy Chan hissed. He is wrong.
And then Malachi knew. Trevor had not been shot by a stranger. His brother, Davenport, had done the deed.
Do you know Mr. Tiffany?
Malachi asked, breaking one of the rules of hypnosis and interrupting the moment to interject a question that might bring the patient out of the episode. But his hunch was correct.
Yes, Judy said. He designed the lamps in the house, the tile work, jewels for the family.
Malachi pictured the note he had found, written in Davenport's hand about the visit to Tiffany's studio so soon after Trevor's death. Had Davenport killed his own brother in order to seize the ancient text describing each lost memory tool? He must have. Then, he'd sought to hide the evidence of his crime in a treasure chest created by Tiffany, to keep secret that which he never meant to share. Not in that life or beyond. And now Judy, in the present, had shot her boss, John Wen, in order to steal the papers back once again. Instantly, Malachi realized the answer to everything he'd been looking for wasn't in the past. It was in this room, staring him right in the face. The Laughing Buddhas.
Judy, Malachi said, his voice urgent. You can hear me now. You need to leave the house in New York. You need to come forward to the present.
Judy remained in her seat, returning slowly.
You are in John Wen's office, he informed her, his rich voice deep and compelling. It is 5 days ago. You have come to see your boss. Then you see a Buddha. Tell me about the Buddha.
It is an 8-inch solid jade Buddha, she whispered, sitting on a square wooden base with gold-seamed corners and inlaid abalone. Mr. Wen has had it for months now. Months when I have implored him to give it to me.
He won't listen to you.
The Buddha must be shared. I begged him. It is wrong to keep it secret, hidden from the world. True power is sharing knowledge in order to help others, not hoarding it for yourself.
Malachi blinked, puzzled.
So you decided to take back what belonged to you. You shot Mr. Wen. You removed the Buddha from his office. Where is the Buddha now, Miss Chan? Tell me, and I will help you share it with the world.
The woman's dark, slitted eyes held a strange spectral gleam. She was not yet in this existence, Malachi realized, but nor was she in the other.
Violence,
she murmured.
It always ends in violence. Brother against brother, spouse against spouse, friend betraying friend. I loved him and I have felt his bullet. I loved him and I struck the mortal blow. Is there truly no other way?
Malachi realized belatedly that Miss Chan was holding a gun, a small antique pistol she'd pulled from the folds of her dress and now had pointed directly at his sternum. He had made a mistake, a terrible, terrible mistake.
You are not Davenport,
he whispered. No, of course not. John Wen had been Davenport, a man who'd shot his own brother in order to keep the legendary text a secret.
You are Trevor,
Malachi continued to Judy Chan. She was the reincarnation of the brother who'd wanted to share the list of lost memory tools with the world and paid with his life. 130 years ago, Trevor had been the victim. This time around, to judge by the pistol held so steadily in Judy Chan's hand, that would not be the case. The secret of the Laughing Buddha had to be shared. And Trevor, Judy, was willing to do it, no matter the price.
I can help you,
Malachi heard himself whisper, his voice hoarse with uncommon desperation.
Show me the Buddha. I think I know its secret. I'll show you, and we can share it with the world.
But Judy's finger was already tightening on the trigger. Lives tumbling over lives. An endless procession of old injustices and fresh pains. Lessons still unlearned. Cycles yet unbroken. The list of lost memory tools forever out of his reach. Malachi lunged forward. The antique pistol exploded to life once again. The moment Dee Dee saw Judy Chan sit down on her sofa, the detective had known the woman was in trouble. The glazed look that had come over her eyes, the sudden slackness of her features. Malachi was doing something to her, drugging her, tampering with a witness, interfering with a murder investigation. It all sounded like probable cause to Dee Dee. She started backpedaling as quietly as one could down a rusty fire escape, then dropped to the ground and picked up her cell. She requested uniformed officers, division detectives, and her squadmates, and she wanted them now. She buzzed the second-story apartment again, frantically seeking entrance. This time, the elderly woman didn't come down, but stuck her graying head out the window above. Dee Dee didn't bother with pretenses anymore. I'm a cop, and the tenant on the fourth floor is in trouble. Open up, quick! The woman appeared to consider the matter. Then slowly but surely, the front door opened, and Dee Dee sprang ahead. Four flights of stairs. Minute this case was done, she was booking more time with the Stairmaster. But for now, around, around, around. She burst onto the fourth floor landing just in time to hear a gunshot. Crap! She threw herself at the door and it flew open, apparently unlocked. Her own firearm drawn, she dropped to the floor and scrambled into the unit, gaze already seeking an injured, possibly even murdered, Judy Chan. Instead, she discovered the woman in question standing quietly before her, smoke still pouring from some ancient-looking derringer.
He lied. He would have kept the Buddha for himself, Judy said calmly. The Buddha is meant to be shared.
Then she handed the strange little pistol to Dee Dee, just as Malachi moaned from behind the sofa.
If you could be of some assistance, Detective. I believe I have just been shot.
Malachi shifted in his chair with some discomfort. Being shot in the leg that had been hurt in the stampede in Vienna years before had been an unlucky break. This time around, however, at least he'd fared better. It turned out Judy Chan wasn't a very good shot when partially hypnotized. While she'd murdered her boss with a single bullet to the heart, her woozy state, the very state Malachi had put her in, had saved his life. 8 months had passed, and now she was in prison, having been found guilty despite an aggressive effort on her attorney's part to prove that she was criminally insane, deluded by visions from a so-called past life. Malachi had sat in the back of the courthouse every day. If Miss Chan's attorney proved that believing what you remembered from a past life meant you were insane, Malachi's own life's work would have been held in question. His passion turned into a joke used against him. But the prosecutor had won. With over 25% of the country believing in reincarnation, and several world religions based on its precepts, the defendant's case didn't pass muster. The jury hadn't accepted the murder was Chan's attempt to right a centuries-long feud. But they did convict her on a charge of second-degree murder stemming from armed robbery. Reincarnation had not lost that day. Judy Chan had.
And now we have Lot 121,
the auctioneer called out in his sing-song voice. Malachi watched as the jade turtle that belonged to the estate of John Wen soared past its estimate of $10,000. The antiques dealer had indeed amassed a very valuable collection of fine antique Chinese treasures. It was a shame he'd had to die protecting one of them. The turtle was removed by a young man in a dark brown uniform, and a similarly dressed man brought out the next item for sale and placed it on the podium.
"And now," said the auctioneer in his Boston accent, "we have the Laughing Buddha, lot 122, a fine example of 8th century Tang Dynasty carving."
The wait for the estate to come to auction had seemed interminable to Malachi. But the police wouldn't release the items in Wen's office until after Chan's trial and arraignment were complete.
"Do I hear 10,000?
The auctioneer called. Malachi had needed to be careful when he'd come to Skinner's to inspect the Buddha before this sale. If he'd shown too much interest in it, someone might have noticed and wondered why. The private viewing room in the auction house where he'd looked it over had a camera in plain sight. Malachi hadn't dared risk trying to take the statue apart to determine if the base might actually be the secret receptacle used by Davenport to hide the list of lost memory tools. But closer examination had revealed such a thing might be possible. The approximate size and shape of the wooden base, the classic Tiffany artistry showcased by the gold-seamed corners and intricately inlaid abalone. In Malachi's mind, the statue's base could very well be the piece commissioned by Davenport from Tiffany himself after that first murder, over a century ago.
15,000 on my right. Do I hear, yes, 20 to the gentleman in the back. Do I hear 25? 25,000, thank you, ma'am.
For the next few moments, Malachi waited for a lull in the bidding. He didn't want to help drive up the price. Expecting a slow in bidding to come at $50,000, he was unhappy when it didn't arrive till the price hit $75,000. But what difference did money make now? With his quest nearly over, the list of lost memory tools about to be his. He had been waiting for decades.
"I have 75,000 from the gentleman in the back. Going once? Twice?"
Malachi raised his paddle.
"Thank you, sir,"
the auctioneer said, acknowledging the new bidder.
"I have 80,000 in the front and 85 in the rear. Now to you, sir, 90,000 in the front."
Finally, after another 5 minutes, the bid was again with Malachi at 150, and there it stopped. Malachi's head was spinning. Was it his?
"Going once? Twice?"
The bang of the gavel.
"Thank you, sir. 150,000 in the front."
Malachi had won his prize. After paying for the jade statue, Malachi took the objet d'art back to his hotel room at the Ritz-Carlton where he'd booked a suite. Carefully and with ceremony, he unwrapped the carved sculpture that rested on a fine base with hammered gold-seamed corners inlaid with abalone. The Tiffany signature had been verified by the auction house. The catalog gave the base alone an estimated value of $10,000. But that did not even come close to what it was worth. Malachi enjoyed pomp and appreciated ritual. He believed in savoring the moments that mark one's life. This was such a pinnacle. He'd reached the end of a long, long road today. Leaving the Buddha sitting regally on the table by the window, Malachi removed the bottle of Cristal champagne he'd put on ice before leaving for the auction house. Opening it with a pop, he poured himself a flute of the pale yellow ambrosia. Raising his glass, he toasted the silent statue and then took a sip, thinking, as he did, of John Wen, who had died for this moment. Of Judy Chan, who was going to rot in prison for her efforts to prevent it.
"The time has come, my friend,"
Malachi said as he walked to the table. He'd done his research. He wouldn't have to remove the jade piece from the pedestal. All he had to do was manipulate the seams on the underside of the base. By pressing them in a certain way, he would, the experts had assured him, reveal a carefully concealed cleft. It was easier than he'd imagined, and as promising as he'd dreamed. The base gave way, a fine sprinkling of dust falling onto the table, indicating it had not been opened in many years. As he'd hoped, no one at Skinner's had discovered this compartment. Malachi didn't look into the hidden compartment. Not yet. The anticipation after so very long was too delicious. He took a long, slow sip of the cold bubbly. This was his moment. After almost 150 years, the past and the present had come full circle. Malachi reached into the narrow enclosure. His fingers felt smooth wood and more smooth wood, satiny. He tipped the piece over, stared into the narrow coffin-like space where he was certain the treasure he sought had once been stashed, where now there was nothing. Malachi Samuels held the statue in his hands and stared into the abyss. For a moment, even though it was nigh on impossible, he thought he heard the Buddha laughing. Or maybe it was merely Davenport Talmage, still hoarding his list of lost memory tools from beyond the grave. Forever his to hide, and Malachi's to seek.
Steve Martini versus Linda Fairstein. Fact. In 1922, Howard Carter, then an itinerant archaeologist who had been combing the Valley of the Kings, discovered one of the largest treasure troves in history. Carter, on a single-minded quest for nearly two decades, unearthed the tomb of the boy king, the pharaoh Tutankhamun. He found subterranean caverns filled with priceless artifacts, hundreds of items of hammered gold, precious gems, and entire chariots crafted from exotic woods. Among those objects was a priceless figurine, a statuette of the boy king perched on the back of a black panther. The cat, carved from ebony, was molded from exotic resins, its formula known only to the ancient Egyptians. Fact. For nearly 90 years, the priceless artifacts from Carter's find, including the panther and its golden king, resided in the Egyptian Museum at Cairo. Then, in early February 2011, in what became known as the Arab Spring, civil unrest gave way to looting. The museum was breached, and among the items taken was the statuette of the boy king atop the black cat. Fact. On September 11, 2012, a marauding band of terrorists attacked the U.S. consulate in Benghazi, Libya, torching the structure and killing four Americans, including the U.S. ambassador. For weeks, the burned-out structure languished, largely unguarded, with documents, some of them highly classified, strewn about in the abandoned wreckage. Got your interest? For two talented writers like Steve Martini and Linda Fairstein, this was all they needed to start a story. Paul Modigliani is the protagonist of 12 best-selling novels by Steve Martini, a former journalist and California lawyer. Linda Fairstein was a lawyer, too, a prosecutor for 30 years, and the head of the Sex Crimes Unit of the New York County District Attorney's Office. Wily prosecutor Alexandra Cooper is her creation. So far, there have been 15 novels featuring Cooper. Crossing swords at a lawyer's conference seemed the easiest way for these two characters to connect. Next, an enterprising young reporter returns from Benghazi and files a story about what she may have found in the burned-out consulate building. When that reporter turns up dead, Modigliani and Cooper find themselves launched on a mad chase in search of the killer and the Golden Boy King. It's a legal thriller for the 21st century. From two masters.
Surfing the Panther.
So what you're saying is that you have no sympathy for the victim?
As I explained previously, I can't discuss a pending case, said Modigliani.
Well then, let's go back to the hypothetical, said Cooper, flashing a smile at him. I just tried to get you to tip your hand about that big case you're trying in L.A. Give the locals here some pointers. The situation we've been given to discuss today has a few similar issues,
I'd like to know what you gain by being so vicious about a dead woman.
There's no lack of sympathy, not on my part.
Cooper ignored his denial. Why is it so many litigators show no empathy for the female victim? In our hypo, she was a woman excelling in a male-dominated vocation. Or maybe you saw her as someone who was socially undesirable. A parasite, perhaps.
Your choice of words, not mine,
said Modriani. He didn't like being cross-examined. Alexandra Cooper made him feel like a witness on the stand. But you agree with that assessment, don't you? You like blaming the victim. She knew she had him over a barrel and was pressing hard. Paul Modriani, a criminal defense lawyer, knew that he'd be making a mistake if he allowed her to mention the case he currently had on trial in L.A. Like stepping on the trigger of a landmine. He tried to figure some way to ease off and keep her focused on this exercise.
Let's just say that a jury is not likely to view the activities of your hypothetical victim as rising to the level of a holy calling. Can we just agree on that? Fair game.
The hypothetical deceased ran a top-tier advertising agency, Paul. A startup she created with her own guts and brain.
She started up more male body parts than one could count, Alex. I'll give you that,
Modriani said.
She also ran an escort service out of her Park Avenue offices.
Some laughter from the audience, but none from Alex Cooper, whose gaze at the moment consisted of two slits, both directed like lasers at Modriani's Adam's apple. To Cooper, a 38-year-old career prosecutor, head of a pioneering sex crimes unit in New York City, these were fighting words. So you think she deserved to die, Paul?
As I said earlier, you have to admit that the woman's death may well have had to do with some of the lowlifes she encountered in the sex trade, and nothing to do with my hypothetical client's business strategies. We have a question from the audience.
The moderator tried to break up the gender brawl with some Q&A. What you're saying, said Cooper, not quite ready to give up the fight, is that a woman operating a legitimate portion of her company, perhaps more aggressively than her male competitors, deserves to be sexually assaulted, then bludgeoned.
That is not what I said.
She deserved the end she got, is that it? Is that the takeaway for the young lawyers here in the audience? Cooper and Modriani found themselves pitted against each other as speakers on a criminal law panel of the New York State Bar Association, debating tactics in capital cases. In today's session, they were using the example of a businesswoman in both legitimate and illegitimate realms who'd been brutally sexually assaulted in her Manhattan office. As the defense attorney, Modriani was representing the hypothetical accused, a rival businessman, and his argument was that the deceased had many more unsavory enemies in her secondary career who may have killed her. In other words, he was casting aspersions on the dead victim's character in order to create reasonable doubt for his client. And Alexandra Cooper wasn't having any of it. Modriani had committed to the engagement months earlier, long before he had a trial date in a similarly high-profile case, People v. Mustafa, which was supposed to be off-limits for the panel's discussion since this matter was now pending, though Cooper was doing her best to rile him on it. He had taken the weekend off to fly to New York and was now beginning to rue the day. Is that your pathetic attempt at a defense? Cooper asked, before he could answer her last question.
That's not what I'm saying at all.
Then perhaps you should explain yourself, said Cooper.
Paul Modriani never needs to explain himself, the moderator said. He's a master in the well of the courtroom. In fact, Alex, since we're almost out of time, I suggest you take our visiting dignitary down to the bar and buy the first round. Isn't that your tradition during jury deliberations? It was nothing personal, Alex, Modriani added. It has nothing to do with the victim's gender.
Alex was used to having the last word. She tried to interject another comment, but could see that some of the attendees were closing their notebooks, hoping to snag an introduction to the two lawyers before they could escape the conference ballroom. Modriani was having none of it.
What I mean is that you don't have the most sympathetic victim in this kind of a situation.
Really? You think anyone deserves to die in such a horrific way? Would it be better for you if it was a male victim who had his genitals mutilated?
No,
he said.
Well, maybe.
Laughter from the audience. Right now, Modriani was beginning to sense what that might feel like. Cooper offered up a smile, the gender card dropped on the table by a skilled prosecutor showing him how it's done.
Can I ask you a question, Ms. Cooper?
Be my guest, said Alex.
I take it you're not on special assignment here, undercover, so to speak, with the L.A. District Attorney's Office, are you?
Lawyers in the audience laughed again. Cooper just smiled. Touché. I tried to get you off mark, Paul, but I couldn't budge you. Better to have met you here than in the courtroom. And thanks for coming to do this. Litigators started moving to the podium in the front of the room. Paul leaned over to Alex as she stuffed her notes into a folder.
The hotel bar in 15?
No.
Don't be a bad sport.
I'm just being a good hostess, Paul. Lose your acolytes and I'll take you to the best bar in Manhattan. Best steaks, too, knowing how you like to devour red meat. Modriani smiled and nodded to accept the invitation. I made a 7 o'clock reservation at Patroon. It's a few blocks away. I'll meet you in the lobby and we can walk over. Alex recognized the first man, 4 or 5 years with the Legal Aid Society doing defense work, who had lined up in front of Modriani's place at the table.
Mr. Modriani, he said, introducing himself and reaching up to shake hands. You're off the record now. I'm just curious to know how you plan to walk the tightrope in your trial in the Mustafa case. I've got something like that coming up in the fall. Like what? You know, the victim in your case, Carla Spinova.
Modriani glanced at Cooper as if to say, you started this. Anyone who saw the news on television knew that Spinova was part of the international paparazzi.
The victim here probed people's secrets with her camera. She rooted through their trash for a living, a provocative career to say the least. A good lawyer has got to use that against the prosecution, don't you think?
Said Paul. Oh, really? Alex asked, resisting the wiser choice of walking away from the discussion. According to the medical examiner, if I recall correctly, Spinova's vagina was ripped in 4 places by a weapon with a sharp serrated edge.
Stick to the hypothetical, Modriani said. I'm in front of a judge in L.A. who'd sooner drop the hammer on me for violating a gag order than parse words after reading my comments in the newspaper.
Either way, Cooper said, a woman who lived on the margins is dead, and you're the one representing her killer.
If there was a global ranking for those who invaded other people's privacy with a camera, Carla Spinova surely would have been seated no lower than 1 or 2 on that list,
Modriani said, lowering his head so that only Alex and the young man in front of him could hear him.
It's not like there's a shortage of potential suspects, people who harbored a great deal of ill will toward her, other dudes who might have done it. So you're not just blaming the victim, you're throwing up some red herrings?
Modriani nodded and thanked the lawyer for his question, then turned to Alex.
I'm ready for that cocktail before I get myself in trouble talking about Mustafa.
You deserve it. And if I were prosecuting your case, Paul, I'd make do with the photographs from the ME's postmortem and take my chances with your high-profile client, Cooper said. Ibid Mustafa was indeed Modriani's client. And at the moment, the skilled attorney figured that God might be on his side. He only had 1,000 or so prosecutors in the LA County DA's office to worry about. The fates had saved him from Alexandra Cooper. On their way out, Modriani greeted a few acquaintances and answered some generic questions about trial strategy. The last straggler asked whether his Southern California firm was hiring. Modriani laughed and waved the young woman off.
Try me again in a year.
Cooper was waiting near the exit. Before Modriani could reach her, he was intercepted by a man who'd been seated in the rear of the audience.
Excuse me, Mr. Modriani.
but I was wondering whether you think the victim's death might have had anything to do with her recent trip to North Africa.
The man spoke with a slight British accent, as if he might have been schooled in the UK but was not born there. He wore a white linen suit and held a Panama hat in one hand, something out of a Bogart movie, Casablanca, a throwback to the 40s. And the victim he was referencing was not the hypothetical ad maven slash madam of the mock trial.
I'm sure you heard me say I'm not here to comment on Mr. Mustafa's case.
Modriani knew about Carla Spinova's trip. He and his investigators had checked it out and found nothing significant to tie it to her death.
But you know she was killed on the eve of her return to Africa, the man said, running a hand around the brim of his hat.
And your point is, said the lawyer,
whether that could have anything to do with her murder.
Not that we're aware of,
Modriani said, assuming the man with whom he was speaking was also a lawyer.
Unless you know something I don't.
The man shrugged a shoulder and sat down in the near-empty room. Modriani felt an ice-cold finger on the back of his neck. He turned around to face Alex Cooper.
I'm getting thirsty, Paul.
I hear you.
I see why you're so formidable in the courtroom. And I hope I didn't come down too heavily. But they told me they wanted the program to have a little heat.
Heat is one thing. Hell is another.
She laughed.
Just make sure the judge and Mustafa doesn't get a transcript.
Not to worry. I can always call the DA out there if he puts up a stink. He's a good friend. And I'm the one who tried to make you go rogue. It's the least I can do after taking advantage like that.
They headed down the escalator and walked out onto Lexington Avenue, with Alex leading the way to the upscale eatery on 46th Street.
Thanks.
Of course, she countered with a grin. It would help if I knew what you were up to as well.
Damn. Are you always on the meter, Alex?
Totally off the record. It will all be on the airwaves after you open on Monday. What's the story?
Paul Modriani was too smart to tip his hand to a prosecutor, a smart one, whom he'd just met hours ago.
Ibid Mustafa's a taxi driver in West Los Angeles, out of work. And Carla Spinova was a Russian emigre who carved notches in her camera case by taking titillating pictures of notables, often in scant attire and at times in compromising situations. She was raped and murdered. That's the people's case.
And that's the part I know, Paul. Everyone does.
Spinova had invaded the private grounds of numerous palaces and royal abodes in the UK so many times that security forces were beginning to think she had a complete set of the beefeater's keys. She was known as the woman who always got her shot. That was, until the night she got her throat slit.
That's all I've got to say about it, Alex.
So we're reduced to war stories for the entirety of an elegant dinner? I'll be a total bore.
I'll take my chances with that,
Modriani said.
I've got all the excitement I need once I hit the ground in L.A. this week.
The maitre d' greeted Alex warmly and took her leather folio as she introduced him to Paul Modriani.
The usual, Ms. Cooper?
Stefan asked, guiding her to a table at the front of the smartly decorated room.
Double down on the doers. It's been a long day.
And for you, Mr. Modriani?
I'd like a vodka martini, straight up.
Certainly.
Stefan handed them each a menu, which they put aside, making small talk about each other's personal life and backstory till the cocktails arrived.
Cheers, Paul. The committee asked me to thank you again for taking the time to do the panel. You put on a good show.
A pleasure to work with you. Hypothetically, that is.
Modriani said.
What do you recommend for dinner?
Before Alex could answer, a shadow descended on the table and they both looked up. The man in the white linen suit, the one who had asked Modriani the question about Carla Spinova's trip to North Africa, hovered in front of them. He held a satchel under one arm, his hat in the other hand.
Sorry, I don't mean to interrupt, but if I might have a moment.
He was looking at Modriani.
I apologize for following you over here, but it's rather important.
Perhaps I should leave, said Alex.
Her prosecutorial instincts were on high alert because of the man's unexpected intrusion at the chic restaurant.
"No, no," said the man. "Don't get up."
"Draw up a chair," said Modriani,
who was intrigued by the man's persistence.
"Join us."
The man did so and sat down. "My name is Samir Rashid. Those who know me call me Sam." He handed each of them a business card. It bore the emblem of the United Nations, UNESCO printed in embossed type across the face. His name, address, and phone number were in small, bold type across the bottom.
"What can I do for you?" said Modriani.
"Perhaps it's what I can do for you," said Rashid. "You are lead counsel for Mr. Ibid Mustafa?"
Modriani nodded.
"Yes."
"I believe I have valuable information that will prove beyond any question or doubt, reasonable or otherwise, that your client did not murder Carla Spinova."
"I think I should leave," said Cooper.
"No, no,"
said Rashid. He placed his hand on her wrist, as if to insist that she stay. "What I have to say is in no way privileged. You are a prosecutor here in New York, correct?"
"Yes."
"Then you should hear me out as well. I don't have much time right now, as I have an engagement I must keep. But I will tell you this. Carla Spinova went to North Africa to take pictures that she thought would earn her a considerable amount of money. Instead, that trip got her killed."
"Go on," said Modriani.
"On September 11th, 2012, the U.S. consulate in Benghazi was attacked and burned. The U.S. ambassador and other Americans were killed."
"Yes."
Paul remembered the tragedy well, as it made headlines with widespread political accusations that were still ongoing. "For nearly 3 weeks following those events, the consulate building, what was still standing, was left unguarded and largely open," said Rashid. "There is also information that confidential and classified documents remained in the rubble. I have it on good authority that Spinova traveled to Benghazi to obtain photographs of the building and its charred interior. She found something when she was there, a document that would have given her what you call a juicy story, which she intended to sell to the news media with her photographs. But before she could do so, she was murdered, and not by your client."
"How do you know all this?" asked Modriani.
"Trust me, I don't have much time to talk right now. But perhaps we can meet tonight at my office at the UN Plaza."
"It's Saturday. The UN building is closed," said Alex.
Her initial skepticism was butting up against details about the horrific tragedy in Benghazi and the fact that the Spinova murder might have had international consequences rather than simply prurient ones.
"I will make arrangements for you to get in. Can you meet me there, say, 9 o'clock?
Modriani had a plane back to L.A. the following morning, but his evening was free after this dinner, and to say that his curiosity was piqued was an understatement.
"I'll be there just as soon as we've finished our meal."
"And you, madam?"
Rashid looked at Alex. "I don't have a stake in the Mustafa case," she said, "and I'm not sure that Mr. Modriani would want me."
"You are a public prosecutor. You made a big deal in our discussion an hour ago about the court system not being a game, Alex. That's your mantra, I think,"
Modriani said.
"You have a stake in doing justice, do you not?"
She nodded.
"Then please, you've been very outspoken about criticizing prosecutors who won't consider exculpatory evidence right up till the time of a verdict."
Alex hesitated as Modriani pressed the